welcome to the Dallas Soccer Show. I'm Dustin Nation, and I'm here with Tristan Vick.
How's it going, everybody?
It's been a busy couple days since we've last recorded an episode. It's been quite the roller coaster of emotions with USA.
Yeah. I don't think there should be intro music, but that's my opinion.
The music has died.
That's right.
Yeah, so since we last recorded an episode, USA has beaten Panama soundly 4-0. And then FC Dallas drew with Colorado 1-1. And then it all came crashing down on Tuesday night in Trinidad with a 2-1 loss. And the United States is now out of the World Cup for the first time since like 1990?
1986.
Oh, man. Even worse.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to just kind of get stuck in here with the USA men's national team, kind of talk about the games and also talk about just the whole system as it is and what needs to happen next for United States soccer. So, Tristan, tell us a little bit about the Trinidad game.
Yeah, so there's not a whole lot to be learned that we don't already know. Everything that's been said about this, I feel like has at times been said already. However, the biggest thing from the Trinidad game was that Bruce Arena put out the same lineup, and it basically appeared as though nobody was playing with any sort of intensity or urgency, and it was as if they had already qualified. And that was sadly not the case, because in the 88th minute of the Panama and Costa Rica game, in the Panama Costa Rica game, sure enough, Panama goes ahead and gets the go ahead goal that puts them through automatically to the World Cup, knocks the United States out of the playoff position and down to fifth place in the hex. It is the most pathetic display from U.S. soccer that I think I've ever seen. There's one player on the field that night that looked like he cared. That was Pulisic. And so there's really not a whole lot to talk about it. I'm not going to watch the highlights. I haven't watched the highlights. I won't watch the game again. I don't want to hear tactical recaps. It just...
That's the only part of the game that I actually got to watch because I was busy last night.
Yeah, it's... So the... I'm a San Antonio Spurs fan, and in 2014, we were winning game 6 of the NBA Finals with like less than a minute to go. And within like 30 second swing, suddenly we're losing, and then we lose the game and the series. It's probably one of the worst losses in sports history. It's up there, or it's worse than the Atlanta Falcons losing to the New England Patriots last year in the Super Bowl. I mean, this is just a total gut punch. So enough about the match. The importance of this, though, cannot be summed up.
Sure. Hey, so you are, I guess, the resident expert on United States soccer. I am still learning about it, learning to care about it.
Sure.
So I've got some questions for you, and let's see if you can't just kind of reason about this together.
Sure. Before we get into the questions, though, sure. I think it's important to kind of talk about what it means to not qualify for World Cup.
That's actually one of my questions. So let's start with right. This. Hey, Tristan, what does it mean to not qualify for the World Cup?
Yeah, so it means different things for different teams. For the United States right now, for soccer fans, there's two types of soccer. There's three types of soccer fans. There is a soccer fan that's going to follow soccer just as much, if not more, no matter what. And that's the type of fan that I am. Then there's the type of fan in the United States that will follow the U.S. national team, or they'll maybe follow Manchester United and not the U.S. national team. And that's the target fan that the World Cup draws in to be more of a complete fan and move up to the first category. And then the third fan is the fan that wasn't going to follow anything except for in the World Cup, and only if it was America. And that's fine. We can get by without those fans. It's that second group of fan that we're not going to get this year, and that's okay. However, as someone who's in that first category that loves soccer, that loves the United States, I can't understate what type of a gut punch this is to soccer fans. And the biggest thing that I can... The biggest thing that I can say with regards to the impact this has had is that it's the World Cup is the biggest chance for us to prove ourselves on the largest stage in the world. Basketball, baseball, football, it's fun because it's your city, your state, your school that's representing, but you don't really play anyone as a country in those sports. We have basketball in the Olympics, but it's really not been competitive the past 2 years. It's not really been competitive. So I'm not even going to consider that. It's definitely the worst loss that I've ever felt, mainly because there was so much hope for various players in this squad, but also there was a lot of opportunity for players to step up and cement their place for the next 5+ years. Guys like Kellen Acosta, guys like Bobby Wood, and now they have a whole nother 5 years to wait until they can do that again with next World Cup in 2022. The reason it feels bad, I think, is that, I mean, I watched that entire match last night thinking we had the possibility of not qualifying, but was in the back of my head thinking.
But you didn't really believe that it would actually not happen.
I thought that even if we shit the bed, Mexico and Costa Rica would do their part and help us out. Mexico had, I mean, we put Mexico through to the World Cup last time around with a Graham Zusi goal that knocked, I think it was Panama, out of the World Cup and instead gave Mexico that spot. And Mexico has, I mean, they wrote songs about Graham Zusi because of that. And that didn't happen. And that's what sucks. And the reason it stings is Americans love being in control of things. And everybody told us that, oh, we're America. Like, we have 300 million people. Like, we'll, of course we'll qualify. But like, no, everybody loves to take the piss out of America because it's the equivalent of punching a punching bag, so to speak, that can't hit you back. And we got beat by the team that hadn't won at home in 9 matches. I mean, Trinidad was not just bad. They're like one of the, they're outside of the top 100 in the FIFA rankings. It's terrible. So here's what opportunity you no longer have is next summer. There's the World Cup. And usually what happens is that a bunch of people get around during the middle of the day. They maybe get off work early. They go to bars and they watch the World Cup and they pretend to be soccer fans. But really the reason they're doing it is because it's their country. And it's the one event that the whole country gets behind jointly as Americans and as proud Americans because they're playing for the flag. And it's even more so than the 4th of July because it's literally happening all at the same time. And there's one objective standard, right? America needs to win the match. It's yep. not, were the fireworks cool? Did you have a good time? Were your friends there? It's, does America win? And that's what we care about. And like the John Brooks game from 2014, when he scores the last minute header to beat Ghana, like insane. I mean, I posted the video today on Facebook of Landon Donovan's goal in 2010 against Algeria that has reactions from all over the country and just bars of people just going nuts when we won that game because we were going through to the knockout round. And the sad reality is, though, that if you go back all the way to the 2006 World Cup, we've only won 2 matches in a World Cup in those years. We won a group game in the 2010 and 2014. So there's obviously a lot of room for improvement. And
that's a very polite, nice way to put it, Justin.
Well, it is, but it's the truth. And so I think that as we grow as a country, which the funny thing about it is that everybody likes to think of America as great at everything. Some people think we're not great and we need to be made great again. But one thing that's definitely has room for improvement is soccer. And so this is a huge wake-up call. It's a slap on the wrist to a lot of players. And we can get into the details now and you can kind of talk to me about what this means. But as a country, we should be jointly reflective of what this means, and our reaction should incorporate those types of feelings in that it's not just about the blame. It's about how do we fix this, and going forward, what role are we going to try to do, or what role can qualifying for the World Cup play in keeping the pressure on players, clubs, and others involved in the game, administrators and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I think it even has an effect on us as fans, right? Not only of American soccer, but as us as American soccer fans and how the world views us. You know, it's kind of been, we've kind of been that running joke to the rest of the world in the soccer world, right? So it's like, oh, they're just Americans, you know, and we're thinking we're on the way up. We're thinking we're improving. We're thinking, you know, oh, we're no longer, you know, going to be looked down upon as much by, you know, the Brits or some of the other powerhouses and everything. And now we are still the laughing stock.
So I would take slight issue with that. I mean, sure. I don't think that anybody thinks that we're a laughing stock because we've produced good players.
Maybe not.
Well, I'm just saying the Chileans didn't qualify. The Dutch didn't qualify.
Yeah, but that's UEFA and South America, right?
I understand, but I think that there's still a number of teams that have not qualified for a World Cup before, and it wasn't the end of the world. And the Men in Blazers podcast talked about how England didn't make the 74 and 78 World Cup, and you're still able to, I mean, I'm going to watch every match I can at the World Cup next year. I'm going to have my teams that I'm going to want to follow. I'm going to be watching tomorrow morning whenever the U17s play against Ghana in the World Cup. I'm going to be watching that. I mean, it's there's still a ton of soccer out there to get excited about. The issue is not, I don't think that we're a laughingstock. I think that it's that we have such good infrastructure and we're wasting it, that we literally could have just a pub team coach from the UK come in and give us more helpful advice than any consultants or board or committees that we create could, would be my take.
Gotcha. So along those lines, with sure. getting a pub team coach, our coach right now is Bruce Arena. He was brought in to replace Jurgen Klinsmann. So obviously Bruce Arena is going to be done right after this shambles.
Yep.
So should he resign now or should he wait until after all of the friendlies and the warmups for the actual World Cup next summer? Cause doesn't his contract, I think it goes till the end of the World Cup. So what do you think should happen with Bruce Arena?
Bruce Arena will probably be replaced within the next month by an interim manager. I could see that being Tab Ramos, who's coach of the U20s right now. He's kind of one of the assistants on the senior team, but it really right now, it should be an interim coach right now that we can have. And then going forward, we have a number of opportunities and paths that we can take on who the new coach will be. I saw tweets from Stephen Goff of the Washington Post before I jumped on here that were saying that the U.S. Soccer Federation is trying to schedule some friendlies for November for the next international break so that we can get some new players in. Then I saw that they're trying to get that as quick as possible. I think that's the right thing to do. I don't think the coach matters as much as it does the players that they bring in and how those players respond. It's tough to get up from something like this, especially for a team like the United States, who's been told their entire lives that you have every opportunity in the world to succeed. All you have to do is try, and they have a performance like they did against Panama, and then they lay an egg just a few days later. So I think that Arena has coached his last game as the U.S. national team coach. I don't think this tarnishes his legacy necessarily because he was already in a tough position and he's done great things as coach in 2002, but yeah, he's gone. I think it'll be only a couple of weeks before he leaves and they'll probably have somebody as an interim.
How far up do you think the sackings should go? Should Sunil Gulati go as well? Or so do we keep him?
Sunil Gulati is the unpaid president of U.S. soccer, and he is an economist by trade. He has been president since 2006, which is a very long time to be president of a soccer federation. He's on the FIFA Council Committee, which is a position he gets independent of his role as soccer president of U.S. soccer. I take the position that Grant Wall took in his article that he wrote this afternoon about what should change, which is that there's new elections next year for president of U.S. soccer. He's run in the past basically with no buddy running against him. I think he needs to come out and say that he has done a lot, but we need new blood and we need new fresh ideas, and that he will not be running and that he can see his term out through February. A couple of important non-player and field-related things that are going on with U.S. soccer. We have the World Cup bid for 2026. He can still do that without being president of U.S. soccer. That's fine. It's not like just because he's not president, we're not going to support him. But there's also the FIFA Executive Council, which he was largely responsible for the new president being voted in last year. And that was a very important thing because obviously that makes Sunil Gulati one of the 10 most powerful people in U.S. soccer. I don't know if that's the case anymore since we won't be at a World Cup, but I mean, there's so much money in the game here in the United States that it's tough to see that position of U.S. soccer and president not being important. I don't think he should resign because what you would have is kind of a, like, so if you read the articles about like the State Department, right? And the importance of having like senior level diplomats doing like the everyday grunt work of being a diplomat and maintaining diplomatic channels. Like, it's very important to keep those foundations. In the same sense, I don't think there needs to be an immediate clearing of the house in U.S. soccer. There is a board that appoints most of these things. If you go on the FIFA or the U.S. soccer website, there's a committee for like everything. And a lot of them are the same people, but it's still, there's a bunch of people that make these decisions, and I don't think we should start just firing them left and right or asking them to resign, especially since some of them are unpaid. So it's kind of like, who else is going to do that right now? But no, he shouldn't resign, but he should be involved and he should let other fresh ideas and be seeking the output or the input rather of the successful club general managers, club owners, people like Dan Hunt here in Dallas, who have been around the game for 30 plus years, guys in Seattle, the Seattle ownership group out there, Paul Allen, Ziggy Schmidt, coaches like that, that really have a understanding of the direction of the game in the United States, as well as the direction of how to improve. So
how do we improve? Say you're on one of those committees, just like you're talking about, what changes would you make? What things are we lacking in, and where would you go about starting to change things?
Right. So it's a very big question. And I won't get into the,
how much time do you have, Tristan?
Yeah, exactly. I won't get into the details at this point. We'll keep talking about it, and then I'll get into kind of some of the smaller level short-term things. But the biggest thing to realize is you got to start saying, what do we have here that is not impacted by this? And what we have that is not impacted by not qualifying for a World Cup is we have an amazing infrastructure. And this is where you can take a look at, I saw a bunch of tweets today and I just wanted to throw my computer through a wall when people were saying the U.S. doesn't qualify for the first World Cup since 1986 or whatever. And and people were saying that it's the worst, whatever, no success, yada, yada, yada. And people are responding to him saying the women have won the World Cup 3 times or whatever, you know, biggest heartbreaks, all these things. And I'm sitting here thinking these people don't know what they're talking about when it comes to comparing the men's game versus the women's game. And I'm not talking about like one's faster than the other. That has nothing to do with men versus women. It's the infrastructure. The infrastructure that the women's game had when they started to win in 1999 and the other two World Cups in the 90s, and then when they finally won again in 2015, was the NCAA that had basically this college system that was able to give 17, 18, 19-year-old women a chance to play on top-level facilities or near top-level facilities with top-level coaching. A number of the women that came from, that were on those World Cup winning teams played at UNC and had really great coaching. And other countries don't have a college system like that. And so the first thing to realize is that the college system is not a strength, but we have infrastructure similar to that that we can build off of. And that is, we have a league that after next year, I think, or in 2 years, it'll be the biggest top division, I think, in the world in terms of the number of clubs. So we have a ton of opportunity for first team playing time at a top level. No matter what you think about the MLS, that's still important playing time. Second is, we have development academy systems that, while they need some fixing and some tweaking, are there and can accommodate players that don't want to go through the traditional method of playing for your school team and instead want to get some professional coaching. That's the next point, is we have a very good coaching infrastructure in terms of, there's a lot of people out there that would coach soccer if given the opportunity. Now we need to tie that all together and connect coaches with the money from US Soccer that Sunil Gulati's done such a great job of collecting. And we need to make sure that the players that are in those academies get the right coaching. And then finally, the last thing that I think that you can kind of view as a strength is that we have a lot of kids that want to play, but they maybe can't play, whether it's financial or whatever other reason. So we need to start identifying talent. The strengths of all of those mean that it has to start at a youth level, in my opinion, for a lot of this, to see the long-term changes. And a lot of people didn't like Jurgen Klinsmann, but a lot of this comes from Jurgen Klinsmann and what he kind of started when he came here. Basically saying that, like, college is great. Go to college if you want to go to college. But if you want to be a soccer player and play on the US national team, like, you can go to college for a year or two, but like this, your chances of being on the US national team are pretty much zilch. And that's just true. I mean, this soccer is the one thing where we can't do it just the American way in terms of our infrastructure. We have to kind of take an approach that the rest of the world takes, and they don't use colleges and stuff. They use clubs. On that note, I think it's worth saying that the pay-to-play system is what you'll hear a lot about. I don't know anything about it. I don't have kids old enough to get into it yet, but I'm sure that it's a controversial issue.
Yeah, basically, a lot of clubs, for their competitive teams and their travel teams and stuff, the kids actually have to pay to be a part of it, pay all the travel. And in other countries, you don't really see that. You don't see the club. Once you become a part of the academy, the club will take care of, like, you don't have to pay the club, and the club will take care of the travel and stuff. So,
right. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of a crappy way to do sports, especially for soccer.
Which one's crappy, the pay to play or the pay for everything for the academy?
No, the pay to play. I mean, I think that's okay. I think it's not at all. I mean, look at the sports where we do well. Maybe you can draw a lesson. Basketball, right? Like, we have the AAU programs that are sponsored by all these teams. Like, why is it so much easier for someone who comes from a inner city background? I mean, there was a guy from Baylor who played AAU and then got drafted by the NBA and played in the NBA, still playing now, I think. And he lived in a hotel room with his mom. And then he was homeless for like his senior year of high school because his mom couldn't keep a job. And like, he was still able to play AAU ball. I mean, like, if we're able to identify the talent, we should invest the money. And one of the reasons this doesn't happen is because a lot of the money that comes from selling players on out of the United States doesn't trickle down to the local clubs. So there's a whole pipeline issue, but ignoring the pipeline issue, the biggest issue is definitely got to be the coaching. I'll go back to this issue. There's really not been a country with the infrastructure that we have that has failed this massively on the world stage in soccer after being so far advanced. And the best example you can come up with is Germany in 2000. And after 2000, the Euros in 2000, they kind of sat around and said, we didn't play well. We weren't looking good. England beat us. Like, that's a big no-no in Germany.
yeah. Well, because England's notoriously bad with their international team.
Right. And so that was a big deal. And so one of the things that they set out to do was they said, we need to change the way this works in our country as a whole. And I've read the book and recommend it to everybody, including you. It's called Das Reboot. You should read it on the plane tomorrow or whenever, but it is.
It's funny. You heard a lot about that yesterday. And actually a guy from work IM'd me and was telling me about, we were just talking about it. And I was like, hey, have you read Das Reboot? he's like, yeah, everybody kept talking about that all yesterday. And I'm like, if you were a listener to our show, you would have known about it several weeks ago.
That's right. And so the best part about that book is the impetus for change is something that's embraced through all levels of the German FA. And so that's the first thing that has to be done, is that the answers that we were getting from Arena and Galati yesterday and today about how we don't need to make wholesale changes, I disagree completely. I would say that there are wholesale changes that need to be made, and we'll get to those here in a little bit. But one of the things that they said in Germany was, we need to make wholesale changes to the way that we identify talent. And it's not about having the best athletes. It's about having the most intelligent players and developing that intelligence from a young age. And that's the first step that our development attitude needs to be. In 2010 and in 2006 and even in 14, you saw a huge emphasis on saying, well, we're really fit, so we can go 120 minutes against Ghana in the quarterfinals or in the round of 16. And we're really good at this because we have a lot of fitness. And it's not good enough to just be able to run. And last night, it didn't look like we had any fitness. Last night. And so that's where it starts, is that attitude about what needs to change. And I think it's a soccer intelligence, it's a technical development, it's letting players want to play the game where they think they're good, and then kind of developing those skills, as well as challenging players to play in the best leagues, but also getting playing time in those leagues too. And so,
it sounds like maybe like you, because you were talking about the MLS being the biggest opportunity because it's going to have so many teams. So you think there's going to be need to be a bigger working relationship between US soccer and MLS, and saying, hey, we need to play more young kids, or how do you think that's going to look?
So I think FC Dallas specifically is really well suited to be a model for how to integrate the kids and into the first team. And here's what I mean by that. If you look at players like Weston McKinney, who's in Schalke, Alex Zendejas is a player who now plays in Mexico for Chivas, who was played for FC Dallas, was representing the United States, but then he decided to go to Guadalajara, which forces you to, they will only play Mexican nationals. And so he had to take his Mexican citizenship and say he would only play for the Mexican national team. But that's a really young winger. There's a bunch of players from FC Dallas that get a lot of first team minutes that are young. And there's also some that don't, and they move on. I think that you have to strike a good balance, but I don't think it needs to be necessarily tilted that way. If we want to go through real quick, let's just first go through kind of where it went wrong for why this group wasn't able to qualify, because there's some really easy, obvious reasons. And then kind of talk about what we need to kind of look for in the short term and the medium term. We can kind of go from there. The league plays an important role in MLS, but I mean, Dustin, the best player has never kicked a ball in MLS for the United States. The second best player, Bobby Wood, has never kicked a ball in MLS.
Yep.
Michael Bradley stopped challenging himself when he came back to MLS from Roma. It's not that the MLS is bad, because the MLS has made CONCACAF much more competitive, and we'll never know what that means because the tournament's expanding in 2022. So if we don't qualify for 2022, then like shut it down, my friend, because everybody's getting in then. But the importance is to go and try, challenge yourself with the best. So, I mean, where it went wrong is there's a great article by Brian Schiaretta at American Soccer who talks about the 1990 to 1994 talent pool. And there's different. So the way that soccer works is you have your years, right? So you have your U17s, U20s, U23s, which is the Olympic teams, which we haven't been to an Olympics since 2008. So that's also a big eek moment for us.
Yep.
And that 1990 to 1994 covers those years where we should have been at the Olympics and performing better. And so the players that fall into that are guys like Terrence Boyd, Breck Shea, Juan Aguidello, Teal Bunbury, Joe Giao, Jordan Morris, guys that are okay, but that they're not first team starters for the national team. And injuries crushed that year, that talent pool. Terrence Boyd was playing for Red Bull Leipzig, which finished second, third in the Bundesliga last year, and was playing for Dortmund and playing for top clubs in Germany in their academies. And then he got hurt and had to take off over a year and a half for an injury. Juan Aguidello, same thing, hugely talented prospect, injuries rail his career. Breck Shea, I've talked about him a few times, but same thing, very talented winger, would have looked great out on the left opposite Pulisic last night, but he just has never been able to prove it consistently on the top stages. And then he has massive injury problems and that really kills your form. Same thing with Teal Bunbury. And then Joe Giao is a guy who played for Dortmund. And I watched a couple of matches. I think he's played once or twice for our national team. And I remember watching him and thinking, this guy is going to destroy teams. Super fast winger, just so fast. And then he goes and gets hurt and doesn't play for 2 years. And Jordan Morris, just for whatever reason, is ineffective at really imposing his will on a game. So we've been left to use people like Altidore to do everything. And this age group did give us DeAndre Yedlin. They did give us Bobby Wood. But that's two players over 5 years, which just really isn't good enough. The next thing that I think is who I already just talked about, Michael Bradley. I think that the first thing you have to do is figure out how Bradley fits into the overall structure of our team. Because last night, I used to get excited when Bradley would start the attack and he got the ball and he just looked like he had no clue what he wanted to do with it. So he's either trying to do too much because he's Captain America or he's not doing what he should be doing and he needs to start focusing on that. We were over-relying on Tim Howard and Brad Guzan. We have an over 33 rule, I guess, for goalkeepers. I don't understand it, but why not let some of the kids play? I get that it's important, but we need to, those guys are gone. And then a lack of a soccer identity is important. I talked about being fit, but the United States really needs to find that soccer identity. And then our arrogance just as a nation in general and CONCACAF World Cup qualifying makes us really vulnerable to other CONCACAF teams. I would not be speaking out of turn if I didn't say that there's one team in CONCACAF that everybody's going to give their best shot to, and that's us for a variety of reasons. It used to not always be that way, but it definitely has been lately. And that sucks, but our players, it puts a little more pressure on the players and we kind of have to step up because of that. So we're known as a soft team for a reason. The United States is not impressive or like strong in terms of the way that people view our country anymore and as a soccer team or as a soccer nation. And they kind of would not really think twice about playing the United States because they know that a lot of our players haven't really been that tested. So that's kind of what caused all the issues.
So that's what caused it. Let's turn it back around and get back to my original big, vague question. From that and given that, what things would you change? Maybe let's just narrow it down to the short term. What would you do in the short term?
Yeah. So let's go back to the Germany model, which was they brought on a new manager. They brought on Klinsmann. They brought in a more of a player's coach, but they also brought in someone to be like the GM of the FA, which is different from the president. The GM focuses on more of the soccer type things, as well as some of the marketing stuff, but they focus on making sure that
be like a more like a sporting director type guy.
Right. Exactly. And that type of a person, there are a couple of people in the United States that have experience with that. And that would be useful. We need somebody like that. We don't really have anyone like that. It used to be that Klinsmann was the technical director and the U.S. men's national team coach. And so he was kind of doing both things or both roles. Next thing, so who, go ahead.
Do you have any names that you, that come to mind for you for that position?
So I really didn't, mainly because it's kind of hard to figure out the, that type of person, but somebody like that knows the MLS well, and then knows some of the management side. And then the one name that's been getting thrown around is this guy, Garth Lagerwey from Seattle Sounders, who played in the MLS and then went and got a law degree from Georgetown and became an attorney. And then he decided he wanted to do soccer. And so he went to RSL. They won some titles. Then he went to Seattle and they've done the same. So this guy would not be a bad choice. The other person that you might consider looking at is somebody like Steve Tarundolo, who's coaching in Germany as an assistant manager. He played in Germany for 14 years. He's from Illinois. He's a played for the U.S. national team in World Cups, but he was just a really good defender right back with lots of experience in all different levels of coaching. And then somebody who, I mean, Bob Bradley wouldn't be a bad person to have there because he's been in so many different situations that he just would have a unique perspective. But if we're wanting fresh ideas, I don't think you can recycle that. The people from FC Dallas, Fernando Clavio, the guy in charge of the academy, like that wouldn't be a bad move. I don't know if you could get him, but you really kind of got to throw a wide net when it comes to that role. But that's the first thing. And that, as far as structure goes, that you would want to do. The next thing that you kind of have to look at is Germany. When they had this, they had the World Cup in 2006 and they had Oliver Kahn, who was the quintessential German, very stiff goalkeeper. I don't know if you ever watched him play.
Oh yeah.
But he was just absolutely, I mean, he was the epitome of what a German is basically. And because of that, Bayern Munich played really odd formations that meant that they couldn't really do much creatively because Kahn would not leave his box. And when they said, we need Jens Lehmann from Arsenal to be the goalkeeper so that we can shift our formations around to let our fullbacks move and to let our defense be more fluid, Oliver Kahn, we have no place for you. You need to retire. It caused a lot of issues. And I think they were okay with that eventually, but that's the type of move that needs to be made. Guys like Tim Howard, Nick Raimondo, Beasley, Guzan, Chris Wondolowski, Graham Zusi, Tim Ream, they need to announce their retirements so that future coaches don't pick them. Like, you can't be picked just if you're retired.
Take themselves out of the running.
That's right. And Fabian Johnson, who in my opinion should have been on this squad and wasn't, he's done. He wasn't going to play friendlies going forward. And he even came out and said it recently that this was probably his last go around for World Cup. And he was excited about the qualifiers, but he wasn't going to really want to play in any of the friendlies unless it was leading up to the World Cup next year. So Fabian Johnson, I don't think you'll see him in a men's national team shirt ever again, which is sad because he was a really promising. I mean, he was one of our best players and has a lot to offer the game. And then finally, I think it doesn't take a lot of obvious thought to realize we need to fast track our defenders and goalkeepers into the senior squad. Ethan Horvath is playing his football in Belgium, really strong goalkeeper who's really not had an opportunity to get his shot. And that is something that we need to really improve upon. I think Jesse Gonzalez has played really well for FC Dallas in these past few matches. I think mentally he has some development that he needs to have in terms of leadership and chemistry and just general temperament. But
yeah, I wonder how much of that is due to the environment that he's playing in right now.
It's possible. It's probably not that all that great with one win and 12 matches. But that
doesn't do wonders for his confidence.
No, it doesn't. But that's the other thing, is that guys like Omar Gonzalez, I mean, our back line, Men and Blazers talked about this today, and I thought it was a really good point, that there's really not been a strong back line for the United States, a back line partnership that you're used to having. England, for years, it was, I mean, you had Terry and Ferdinand, as well as Terry and Cahill. And now you've got John Stones and who's the other guy that they play with a lot. But they've got a backline partnership, and that's a huge deal to have in terms of the defense, right? Oh, Chris Smalling. So, and Cahill. But those types of partnerships are crucial for a national team to succeed, because when you pull out the sheet and you say, who's my 11? You're able to know right off the bat, I'm going to put this guy in, and that defense is good. If I want to play a more attacking fullback, I can do that because I know these two will be good. If I want to put a more attacking defensive midfielder in, I can do that because these two are good. And I don't know who those two players are. I think John Brooks is one of them. I think John Brooks is someone who is really passionate about playing for the national team. And that's good to know, because that guy's a beast. And if he were healthy, this wouldn't have happened. And if we had,
yeah.
So that's something you got to look at.
Yeah. That's the one that comes to mind for me, but I have no idea who that second one would be either.
So there's a few names that they bandy about. There's Cameron Carter-Vickers from Tottenham, who's playing at Sheffield right now on loan. That kid's really smart, but he still needs to develop physically. I don't think it's somebody like Matt Hedges. I don't think Omar Gonzalez is really improved despite playing a lot of minutes in Liga MX. I feel like he's kind of regressed, actually. I think Jeff Cameron can keep playing. As long as he's playing for Stoke, let him go in there and teach this back line. But I don't think that we need to build the team around him. I think you need to build the team around John Brooks and finding a partner for him. And then we'll go from there. That's the biggest focus, and then obviously the goalkeepers and making sure that that's taken into account, because I mean the whole entire back line is a joke.
So get rid of the over 33 rule for goalkeepers is in that list of things you do short term.
Yes. And and that's the problem with having repeat managers as managers, is they go with what's comfortable. And
sure,
Bruce is comfortable with Tim Howard and Brad Guzan.
So what about after that, is there anything more medium or long term that you would do? If you were if you're orchestrating the puppet master of all US soccer things?
I mean, the biggest thing would be to steal the World Cup back from Qatar in 2022, but then you don't have to qualify. The biggest thing, like medium term, that we need to do is there needs to be a true come to Jesus moment for US soccer in terms of, are they going to put the growth of the game over making money? Because if you do put the growth of the game over just straight up making money, you'll see a return. I think that the Bundesliga is proof of that. I think that MLS is proof of that, that MLS is growing its fan base, and for the most part has quite a loyal fan base. So I think that's really important. And then also it'd be great if we were able to maybe get some of these new players in that we think we can build around and go up against some of these squads that will be in Russia next summer. Schedule friendlies with some of the powers out of South America. Let's see what happens when we schedule a friendly with Argentina. And they probably won't bring Messi because it's a friendly, but maybe we go up against Di Maria or Aguero when he's back healthy.
Or Higuain.
Right. And so these are the types of teams that we need to be beat by, because we will lose, but we need to play against, and we need to say that's where we need to be at and grow from there. And CONCACAF is not something that's going to make you better necessarily, as much as it is something that's going to prove what you already know about your team. And there were a lot of question marks with this team, and we didn't know whether or not they were built for playing away from home. And it wasn't even a hostile environment. Dustin, there were like 1,000 people at this stadium, and 50 of them were Americans, and the other half of them were drinking and just hanging around because there was nothing to do in Trinidad that night. I mean, nobody was like going nuts about this. You could hear Bruce on the telecast shouting. I mean, it wasn't hostile. So what we learned was it's very hard to motivate professional soccer players who have been playing for a very long time, because a lot of those players have been, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, most of those players have been to a World Cup. The ones that hadn't, surprisingly, looked better than the ones that had. So,
which is weird, because in the game against Panama, you could kind of see that some of the older players, like Jozy Altidore, like you could see him step it up, like he really wanted to go, and he really wanted to go out and you know, go one more time. But then turns around in the Trinidad game and just kind of, from all accounts that I heard, he just didn't, it looked like he either didn't have it or was not really caring too much.
Yeah. So the pitch was really crappy, but it wasn't the worst thing they've ever played on. And literally Saturday, I watched Belgium and Bosnia play on a pitch that looked like it had been hit by a minefield or been blown up as a minefield. I mean, there was bumps everywhere. But
Belgium still got the job done.
Yeah, Hazard still is able to make a run. Fellaini's still able to do Fellaini things, which I think
he
got hurt, actually. But that didn't stop Kevin De Bruyne from making runs down the wings. And that's the type of confirmation hunger, and hunger. Yeah, and hunger that you want to see from our players. And that was non-existent. And I think that as we look for signs of improvement, we have to test ourselves against the best. And that means playing the best. So hopefully they want to play us, because that would be great. But who knows? They may just think that we'll just roll over. I think that if you want to go on the next thing is the coaching or whatever. I mean, I'll give you my pick for who I think would make a great coach.
Sure, let's do that. One last thing. Let's hear your pick for the coach, and then we'll wrap things up here.
Yeah, so I'll do a couple, because there's two different ways to go. You can say we need somebody that knows the game really well here in the States, and that we need to get someone who won't be too big of a change. And that player is, or that coach, is Peter Vermees from Kansas City. Not saying he'd be a bad coach, but I would say that would be the safe pick. And he's a defender, so I like that he has that on his mind. But at the same time, I think that we need to maybe look beyond that. The player, the coach that I would go for first is the Atlanta United coach, Gerardo Martino. Tata Martino, whatever you want to call him, but that guy is played, coached at all different levels. And from everything that people hear, the way that he's treated Atlanta, everybody loves him on that team. And his managerial style is quick. He will drill into these players how to play. And if you're looking at future players for the U.S. national team to make impacts on the U.S. national team stage, doesn't hurt to have one of the coach of some of those players. Guys like Chris Gosselin, who's playing right now, who's playing really well for the U.S. national team. Andrew Carleton, who's on the U-17 team and is just tearing it up right now. He's done a great job. And that would not be the worst decision anyone's ever made before. The other pick that you could go for if you want to kind of go crazy is you could look at somebody like Marcelo Bielsa, which is the guy that created the 3-5-2 kind of system, the Chilean quick fullback type system. And finally, if you really want to go bold and really throw things up, is go for Carlo Ancelotti. He has no job right now. He's never coached internationally. But you know what? The guy's coached. He's literally done everything but win a World Cup. He's won Champions Leagues at Milan. He's won them.
You think he'll be around Madrid? Long enough to get us to a World Cup?
He's only 58.
Oh, I just thought he looks older.
Yeah, no, he does. He does. I didn't realize, but he is. He's only 58.
So I think that, you know, obviously I'm not as knowledgeable in this area as you, but if they do, if they are going to follow your advice and they do hire a sporting director, I think that what you do is you hire somebody that knows the American landscape for that, and then you go balls to the wall for the coach. You get somebody who's just going to come in here and boss everybody into shape and for the manager. But that's me.
Yep, I would agree. I think that's not a bad way to approach it.
So I don't know enough about it to be able to give you names, but yeah. So, all right, folks. Well, that's about all we've got for you for tonight. Don't drink too much after this. Life will go on. It is sad, but we...
No, I wouldn't say that, but I would say that keep the pressure on players to let them know that while you support them, you want to see them improve. And so one of the things that made me feel good about that is I started a list on Twitter because I'm a big Twitter list guy, I started a list of young U.S. men's national team players that are all U-17s or younger, and they're not tweeting. So they're focused, they're playing, they're not doing Freddie Adu things or Breck Shea things. They are focused. And so I think this U7, I mentioned earlier, and I'll leave you with this positive stat. Here's a happy stat.
All right. I love ending things with a positive, Tristan.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what I was trying to do earlier, but.
So we've got 2 wins in the past 4 World Cups and at the national level, but our U17 team is going for their second win or their third win of the group stage of just this year, tomorrow. Our U20 team made it to the quarterfinals this year. They made it to the quarterfinals last or in 2015. So the youth pool is there. It's just got to keep getting developed and keep growing. Yeah,
you just got to make that transition from the youth into the
That's right.
first team.
So as long as we keep that 15 to 20 pool age range going, and we get those 20-year-olds playing first team minutes for big clubs or just any club and developing and keep growing, that's what's going to make it healthy.
All right. So FC Dallas has got Seattle at Seattle this weekend. We kind of need a win. I guess Houston lost or won tonight against Sporting Kansas City, making a win all the more imperative. So we will have reaction to that next week. And so we will talk to you then. Thanks for listening, everybody.
All right.